Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to Marriage Fitness with Mort Fertel. This is Mort Fertel, and this is your fifth teleseminar in a series of seven. I want to begin with a review of what we discussed last week and in the previous weeks, and then we'll dive right into the exercise that I want to do with you and the material I'm going to share with you tonight. So we met 5 weeks ago, and I introduced to you what I think is a surprising solution to your marital situation, which is to identify your problems and your issues, but not for the traditional purpose of addressing them, attacking them, resolving them, or discussing them, but so that you can succeed to develop some ways to table them, to put them aside temporarily, so that you can clear the way to implement some positive relationship habits that will begin to build the goodwill between the two of you. Many of you have already experienced, even in 4 or 5 weeks, the impact that this can have on a relationship. And in many cases, you're realizing that it's really what your relationship needed all along. Some of you, even some of you who have seen the impact that this has had, are finding yourselves, understandably, a little impatient. Meaning that, okay, Mort, I see that things have gotten better. There is a certain more warmth between us. But those problems, I'm a little anxious about them. And when are we going to resolve them? When is it going to go away? When and how is my spouse ever going to realize that things can't continue with him or her doing whatever it is that they're doing? Patience, my friends, patience. Clearly you are moving in the right direction. Anyway, in week two, we got right to work to learn some of those positive relationship habits that you could implement. And I introduced to you what I think is the first pillar of relationship success, which in three words I call put love first, making your spouse and your marriage the absolute highest priority in your life. Many of you over the course of your lives have succeeded in different things, whether it be with your kids or with your work or hobbies or interests or sports. And very often it's that emphasis or those priorities that to some extent, at least partly, has cost you the most important thing in your life, which is your marriage. And if you're going to succeed in your marriage in a lasting way, you've got to be prepared to make it the top priority. And by the way, I recommend that not only so you succeed in your marriage, but so you succeed in your life. I did a radio interview a couple of mornings ago, and the interviewer, one of the things that she was really intrigued about that she asked me about was that small section of my book where I talk about how your marriage is not one part of your life. It's not like, well, you know, there's my work, and there's my job as a parent, and there's my marriage, and there are my hobbies and interests and my family. And okay, so maybe I succeed in a few areas, and I fail in a few other areas, but overall, maybe I could be happy. Your marriage is not one aspect of your life. It's the context of your life. It's the pool inside of which everything else swims. It's the bedrock upon which everything lies. That's why we talked about last week, moving from me to we and the whole interdependence of the universe, that is the first step beyond our own individual physical survival. The next real basis for our existence is a connection with another human being. And so, putting love first and making your spouse a priority is not just about succeeding in your marriage, but it's about finding happiness and fulfillment in your life. And we've all had the experience that when we're in love, everything is great. You look good, you feel good, you got a hop in your step and a twinkle in your eye. Everything else could be falling apart, but if you're in love, all that remains. And yet, if you're not in love, if your marriage is failing, you could exercise twice a day, you could make all the money in the world, you could look good, you could dress in the latest fashions, be a powerhouse in the community, and know all famous people. But something deep in your heart will be empty. You'll be in pain. And when your head hits the pillow at night, you'll be lonely and unhappy. Because it doesn't matter how much you succeed in other areas of your life, there is nothing that can fill that gap. Anyway, in that week, we talked specifically about some ways that you could put love first, namely date night, talk charges, and touch charges. Now, once again, just a brief reminder, there's nothing incredibly magical about those three relationship habits, except that they work, and that they're fairly easy to apply to almost every situation, so I can't encourage you enough to find out how you can apply them in your situation. But don't get trapped in them. Don't get stuck in them. There are probably hundreds of other ways in which you could manifest put love first in your marriage, and you should be exploring those ways, discovering those ways, and implementing and executing them in your marriage. We also talked, just as a brief reminder, because it's important, it actually came up over the last couple of days with some people I'm in private sessions with, we talked about the importance of discipline. And it seems that no matter how much we talk about it, still a person is vulnerable to saying, you know, Mort, I just don't want to. You don't want to. Okay? So you don't want to? That doesn't matter. There's a lot of things in life we don't want to do that we do anyway because it's the right thing to do, because it's good for us, because it's the only way we're going to be able to find out whether or not this can work. It requires discipline. Discipline is doing what you don't want to do when you know you need to do it. It's a key ingredient to succeed in anything in life. And without it, you can't succeed in anything, including your marriage. In the third teleseminar, we talked about the correlation between giving and love. And we talked about how, in the beginning, when you fall in love, a person is naturally compelled. They don't have to think about it too much. They don't have to get too motivated or inspired. They're just naturally compelled to give to their beloved. But I think I demonstrated to you that the relationship or the correlation between love and giving works the other way as well, meaning that through the habit of giving, you can create, you can manifest an experience of love in your life. And so I think I told you, I can't remember if it was on the teleseminar, I was speaking to somebody privately, but I think I told you about a little tiff I had with a neighbor once. And I couldn't quite get it out of my heart, my feelings for him. The relationship was a little soured, and yet this person was a neighbor. I spoke to one of my mentors about how I should handle this, and he advised me that I should demonstrate kindness to him, give to him. So I said, you don't understand. I'm trying to figure out how to get him out of my life. He said, I'm explaining to you, I want you to give to him. So he said, I want you to give something to him every single day this week. So I did so. I came back to him. I said, nothing's changed. In fact, I resent all the things I gave to him and I want them back. He said, okay, great. I want to give you your assignment for this week. You ready? I said, yes, I'm ready. Give to him this week again. So I gave to him again every single day something during the week. I let him borrow something, or I did him a favor, or I extended some kind gesture. I came back to my mentor. I said, I did it. Now I'm even more angry. Nothing has changed. He said, I want to give you your assignment for week three. Do you know what it is? I said, well, let me guess. It's to give to him. So he said, correct. I continued this, and he was right. Eventually it worked. Around his yard, around my neighbor's property, in his house, I kept seeing more and more of me and our relationship in him and in his things. And my mentor was right, that eventually it really did clean out my heart. And not only, and I didn't get him out of my life, he came back into my life in a much more positive way. We talked also not only about the importance of giving, but about the importance of giving in a way that your spouse feels deeply understood. And when you give to somebody in a way that they feel understood, you can melt them. Because the need to be understood is one like oxygen for a human being. It's one of the most basic needs that a human being has. And yet most people don't feel understood, even by the person that sleeps next to them every night. And it's usually one of the biggest problems in a marriage, is that people don't feel understood. And yet, one way to One powerful way to help your spouse feel understood is not to tell them you understand them. That's actually the worst thing you can do. Don't tell your spouse you understand them. Demonstrate to them that you understand them. As I keep reminding you, say little and do much. Stop talking. You will not be able to talk yourself out of a situation you behaved yourself into. You will not be able to talk yourself out of a situation that you behaved yourself into. These situations get to where they're at because of choices that people make. And if you want to get out of those situations, you got to begin to make new choices consistently. Last week, I introduced to you a theme or another pillar of marriage success that I call synergy, or moving from me to we. And we talked about the emphasis in our culture on independence, but how really the highest expression of human maturity and development is not independence, but interdependence. And it's the merging, the blending, the connecting your life with another person's life. And although many people and even counselors will advise people to not lose themselves, right, and to strive for their own happiness, ultimately happiness is like a boomerang. If it comes back to you, you've missed the target. The more involved you are, particularly with your spouse, the more you'll feel complete. Not like you've lost yourself with them, but actually complete. After all, isn't that how we feel when we fall in love? You feel complete. You feel like there was a part of you that was always missing that is now whole. Isn't it ironic that when a marriage gets to the place that so many of yours is at, that we feel the exact opposite, which is that we have some extra baggage that we somehow have to get rid of in order to re-establish ourselves, our independence. But that's only because the relationship is become dysfunctional. And if we could re-function it, so to speak, once again, we would feel complete. Not because we've achieved independence, but because we've reconnected with our spouse and returned to an interdependent state of existence. Tonight, I want to continue to develop this theme, this idea, this principle of moving from me to we, synergizing, but I'm going to come at it from a very different angle. It might not necessarily be so obvious that I'm talking about the same thing at first, but by the end, I hope you'll see the connection. Before we dive in, I want to make sure that you all have what you need. Everybody should have a 2-foot-long piece of string, as per my announcements and my email. And you're also, in a few minutes, going to need a partner. Now, let me just make this announcement one last time so that everybody's prepared. When I say a partner, if you're in the duo track and you're together there in the same room, so of course you're all set. But if you're in the duo track and you're separated, or your spouse is traveling, or if you're on the Lone Ranger track, so then you're going to need a partner in a few minutes, for a few minutes, to do an exercise with this string. Now, let me explain how this is going to work one final time. This will not compromise your privacy at all. It can be anybody over the age of 10 years old. You may have even taken the opportunity to invite your spouse, if you're in the Lone Ranger track, to join you for this. Once I invite you to get your partner, which I haven't done yet, so hold on, I will not mention Mort Fertel, marriage, fitness, marriage problems, reconciling relationships. There will be no discussion whatsoever of marriage. And the person listening, the person in the room with you, will have no idea who's on the phone, and they won't know what it's about. As far as they're concerned, there's going to be this strange voice coming over the phone giving them instructions on what to do with this piece of string. And we'll complete this exercise. And then, after we do, I will prompt you to escort your spouse, escort your guest out of the room. I'll give you 30 seconds to do that. I will confirm that everybody has the privacy that they want. And then I will continue with the presentation And of course, they'll explain how this seemingly transparent exercise is actually very germane to your situation. Okay, so I'll give you now about 30 or 60 seconds to go get your guest. You may do that now. Go ahead. For those of you that don't have somebody in the room with you. Okay, so here's what we're going to do, everybody. You should all have a piece of string approximately 2 feet long. Here's what I would like you to do. I would like each of you to take your dominant hand and place it behind your back. So if you're right-handed, place your right hand behind your back. And take your non-dominant hand, each of you, and work as a team to complete the following tasks. Number one, tie the string into a knot. Number two, make a bow with the string, like as if you were tying your shoelaces. Number three, make the bow into a double knot, as if you were double tying your shoelaces. Number four, take the string and tie it around the wrist of one of the partner's non-dominant hands. Once again on that one. Take the string and tie it around the wrist. Tie a knot around the wrist of one of the partner's non-dominant hands. So just to explain a little bit, unless somebody is double-jointed, that's going to have to be done by one of the partners, right? Because the string is being tied in a knot around the other partner's non-dominant wrist, and that's the only hand they can use. Their dominant hand is behind their back. So you got the picture there. Then, take the string and tie it in a knot around the other partner's non-dominant hand. So once again, it's the same task, but just done by the other partner, and unless that partner is double-jointed, once again, it'll have to be done by just one partner. All of those tasks should be done consecutively without undoing the previous task. So, for example, the first task was to tie the string into a knot. The second task is to make the string into a bow. You should make it into a bow without undoing the knot. And so on. Once you've got the bow, now you're going to make a double bow. Then tie it in a knot around one person's wrist and in a knot around the other person's wrist. All consecutively without undoing the previous task. So obviously you're going to have less and less string to work with as you move along. Once again, this should be done as a team, and with both persons' dominant hands behind their back, and each person using only one hand, their non-dominant hand. You may begin. I'll give you a few minutes to work on this. Once again, a knot, a bow, a double bow, a knot around one person's wrist, and another knot around the other person's wrist. Consecutive tasks without undoing the previous task. Each person using only their non-dominant hand. Okay, very good. So let me ask everybody to stop here. If you haven't completed all the tasks, don't worry about it. It's not a problem. Let me ask you to stop anyway. And at this point, I'll give our hosts an opportunity, if you would like, to escort your guests to wherever you want to escort them to. I'll give you 30 seconds to do that. Okay, now let me just confirm, does everybody have the privacy that they desire? Because I'm going to go on with the presentation, and our subject matter will once again become clear. Okay, so besides just giving you the opportunity to tie the knot again, get it? What really is this all about? Let me share with you that when I do this in live public seminars, meaning when we're all actually in the same room, it's interesting how I can visually see that the group breaks down into four distinct categories, and I want to explain to you what they are, and I think that the purpose for this exercise and the insights from it will start to be obvious. And my guess is, by the way, that my real message and my real point in having you do this is probably very different from what you think it is. You see, when I do this all over, inevitably the group breaks down into four segments. The first group of people are people who succeed to complete the tasks, and they have fun doing it. Which is not surprising, because people like to win. And so when we do win, when we do succeed, it's often that we have fun doing it. A second group of people are the group of people who also succeed to complete the tasks, but they practically kill each other in the process. They didn't have fun. It was a disappointing experience, even though they may have succeeded. Now, I'm going to speak stereotypically for a second, but you know, you'll excuse me. I think you'll understand my message. When I tell you that very often this second group occurs when there's some very success-oriented, driven, dominant man who wants to be the first one in the room to raise his hand and say, "Mort, I'm done. I did it. We've succeeded. I'm your marriage fitness champion." And so he'll raise his hand up, being the first one, with his hand still tied to his wife's wrist, jerking her wrist up. You can see that she's like hanging from his arm. She's sweating from the stress of going through this exercise. He's got a big smile on his face because he's proud, and she's devastated. She came here to try to improve upon her marriage, and here she just had this terrible experience getting tied to her husband. And so they succeeded to complete the tasks, but he did it in such a way that it soiled the experience, the process. The third group of people are people who failed to complete the tasks and, not so surprisingly, also did not have fun trying. And that's not so surprising. Why? Because once again, we like to succeed and we don't like to fail. And when we fail, when we blunder, so then we don't have so much fun, we don't feel good about it, and it puts more stress and strain on our relationship. The fourth group of people is a fascinating group of people. Something we can all learn something from. And inevitably, this usually is an older couple. And this fourth group are a group of people who fail to complete the tasks. However, they had a silly fun time doing it. They had a blast. it's very often an older couple who has lost their dexterity, and it might even have been physically impossible for them to complete the tasks. But you heard them giggling, tickling each other, being silly. At some point in the process, they may have even given up following the directions and gave up even trying to complete the tasks. But they continued to laugh. They continued to have fun. And really, my friends, they achieved the most important task, which was the completion of their relationship. You see, the point of the exercise that I just took you through was not to tie the knot. It was merely a decoy. The point of tying the knot was to use that as a means to the real end, the ultimate end, which was whatever happened in your relationship. Not whatever happened, the end, the real goal is to use it as a means to succeed in your relationship. Research proves that the difference between successful and unsuccessful marriages has absolutely nothing to do with the list of problems or the extent of problems that a couple has in their life, in their marriage. Now, that's surprising. I mean, you would think that the more problems a couple has in their marriage, and the more extensive, the higher the drama of those problems, then you would think the more likely it is that they are to have a strained marriage. But in fact, the research shows that there is no correlation between either the number of problems or the magnitude of the problems in a marriage and the success of a marriage, which is fascinating. Actually, what's really interesting, you ready for this statistic? I bet nobody could guess what the variable is in a marriage that is the number one predictor of divorce. In other words, what is the dynamic in a marriage that is best able to predict that this marriage won't make it? It's the avoidance of conflict. What? The avoidance of conflict? Mort, if I could only succeed to avoid conflict with my spouse, we'd be fine. No. That's not what the research proves. Research proves that if you succeed to avoid conflict, if you succeed to avoid problems, you will actually increase your chances of ending up divorced. You see, the fact that you have problems and conflict is not necessarily a bad thing. It means you're close. It means that you care. Hate is not the opposite of love. Apathy is. When you really are close to somebody, inevitably you're going to step on their toes. It's a sign that you're close. It's a sign that you care. Problems in conflict are not necessarily a problem in your marriage. As you'll see in a moment, they can actually be, and they are, a tremendous opportunity in a marriage. I remember a number of boot camps ago, I was working with a couple. We were also in private sessions together. And I was first introduced to them when they came in during one of the Q&A teleconferences. They came in about halfway through the teleconference. And prior to them coming in, it was one of the most intense Q&A teleconferences I think I've ever done. Because the people that came on the line initially had extremely dramatic and traumatic problems. And so the first man came on, and he talked about his wife that was involved in an affair. And the second person came on was a woman whose husband was trying to get her involved with ménage à trois. And the third woman that came on, her husband was, quote, addicted to pornography. And the fourth person that came on, he felt that he was being emotionally abused by his wife for years. And it was just these very dramatic and traumatic problems and issues, and it was incredibly draining, and we could all really feel the stress in these marriages and almost the exhaustion of talking about these intense issues and problems during the course of like these 45 minutes. Then this other couple came on, and they started he actually was the one that pressed 6, came on, said, "Hello, Mort, this is whatever his name was, and my wife and I, we're on the brink of divorce, and I can't tell you how angry and frustrated I am." And as he was saying this, I could almost feel his hand shaking in anger and frustration. And there was this big build-up about how long this has been going on, and how frustrated he is, and how insensitive she is, and about how he's checked with an attorney, and he's trying to understand how to deal with this with the kids. And I finally said, "Okay, so out with it already. What's the problem? What would you say is the root of what's going on between the two of you?" He said, "Oh." He said, "You know what it is?" He says, "For 25 years, I've been asking my wife to close the garage door. And for 25 years, it's been ajar." You hear this? He wasn't kidding. He was totally serious. The fact that she left the windows open and left the garage door ajar drove him absolutely bonkers. He couldn't handle it. It wasn't just him. They couldn't handle it in their marriage, and they were literally on the brink of divorce, coming to Mort Fertel because the garage door was always open. Now, I could almost feel everybody else in the Q&A teleconference kind of chuckling, like, "Gosh, I wish I had that problem." I wouldn't be here. I would trade my marriage for that situation any day of the week. But you see, that's not the way I felt. That's not the way I handled it on the teleconference at all. Because I know the research, and I've dealt with enough couples to know that that couple's problem is just as serious in their marriage as the previous couples who were dealing with infidelity and all kinds of other traumatic and dramatic things. Because once again, there is no correlation between the type, the magnitude, or the extent or number of problems in a marriage and the success of that marriage. The issue is not the problems. The issue is how those problems are handled in the context of the marriage. If the problems are handled appropriately, if they are approached as a team with sensitivity, consideration, if they're dealt with in a certain way, which we're going to describe in a few minutes, then the most difficult and traumatic problems can actually be not problems, but opportunities to build a relationship. The truth is, and I've mentioned this to some of you privately, that the best marriages that I know of, I mean the best, I'm not just talking about people that don't become a divorce statistic and manage to survive in their marriage for a lifetime, but I'm talking about the people that really thrive. The really best marriages, inevitably, are between couples that at some point hit rock bottom. The best marriages are between people who had the worst nightmares very often. And the reason their marriage got so strong, the reason they both grew so much together, was because of how they handled the magnitude of those problems, how they handled those problems in their marriage. So whether it be the loss of a loved one, the pain of infidelity, the gnawing, constant gnawing of years of neglect, whatever the situation may be, how a couple ultimately deals with that problem. A problem child, by the way. Financial stresses. Right? I had a discussion with somebody recently that talking about how, they have everything. I mean, cars and homes and money and financial security. Now, most people without all of that would think, gosh, that would solve so many of my marital problems. You know, I mean, if you look at very unsophisticated surveys, people say that one of the most common marriage problems are money problems. In my experience working with people, they'll say it's money, but when you really get down to it, it's not about money. And there are many couples that I know that don't have hardly any money and have financial stress in their life. But sometimes that stress, like any other stress, could actually be a catalyst for them coming together, bonding, connecting, uniting, working as a team. And that the challenge of tying that knot becomes something, whether they succeed or fail, that unites them, that brings them closer together. And so the issue is not whether you succeed to tie the knot or not. The important point is what happens to your marriage in the process. Because if you succeed to tie the knot or solve any other problem, but you soil each other in the process, what will you have? Whereas if you work together, treat each other with kindness, goodness, sensitivity, include each other, get each other's input, feedback, make each other a part of your lives. And if you do that with the problems that exist in your life, then even if you don't resolve the problems, if you build the relationship in the process, so I'll ask you again, where would you be? You'd love to be there, right? I mean, that's why all the great love stories, I think I mentioned this last week, right? All the great love stories inevitably include some tragedy. They include some obstacle. And somehow the couple used that tragic obstacle to make love. I want to share with you something else that is not, I admit, is not a perfect metaphor for the point that I'm making, but it is related. I'll explain how it's related, and then I'll also explain how it's not perfect. You know, many couples, as I mentioned, would say that money problems is one of their most significant issues. And so, what do you think would happen to your marriage if you hit the lottery and won, let's say, $100 million? Well, almost everybody would say, you're kidding. I mean, it certainly couldn't hurt, right? I mean, if we won $100 million, that, in fact, would solve many of our marital issues. Things would be easier. We could spend more time together. We wouldn't have to work. He probably wouldn't neglect me. We could go away on vacation. We could buy all the nicest things. We wouldn't have any trouble sending our kids to college. I mean, if we hit the lottery, that would definitely have a positive impact on our marriage. So once again, I refer you to the research. If you ever win the lottery, the first thing you should do with a significant chunk of that money is hire Mort Fertel, because you're going to need them. Why? Because the research proves that winning the lottery for marriage, winning the lottery is the kiss of death for a marriage. The divorce rate amongst people that hit the lottery is statistically dramatically higher than almost any other single event that could occur in a marriage. So what's my point? Well, I'll tell you what my point is, and then I'll tell you what it's not. Point is that just as there is no I mean, it just demonstrates that here something positive happens in a marriage or in someone's life, presumably positive, seemingly positive, a windfall of money. I mean, inherently, money is not a bad thing, right? In fact, it's fine. It's good. It's a good thing. Nothing wrong with having money. But here we find that that when a good thing, just as when a bad thing happens, it doesn't necessarily cause the deterioration of a marriage, so too when a good thing happens, it does not necessarily cause the improvement in a marriage. Now, here's where the story is not perfect. It's not a perfect explanation, because actually my point when it comes to problems and issues is that there is no correlation. But the story that I just told you about the lottery, there is a correlation, but it's inverse. It's the opposite of what you would think it would be. You see, the problems are not the problems. Now, when I say that, I mean something different than I meant in week one. When I said that in the first week of the teleseminar, well, my point was that your problems are not your problems, and if you think your problem is your problem, that's your problem, because usually what happens is you need to table your issues and problems and go to work building the underlying root of your relationship. And people get distracted by their problems, they focus on them, and they just immerse in the negativity of their situation, and it makes things even worse. That was the message in the teleseminar that I shared with you in week one. Here I'm saying your problem is not the problem, but my point is different. Your problem is not the problem, because the problem is not something that inherently will destroy your marriage, no matter what the problem is. What's really crucial is how you handle that problem in the context of your marriage. If it is handled well, then regardless of what problem it is you're dealing with, that problem can be transformed into an opportunity and actually used as something that builds your relationship rather than crushes it. There's a powerful story that I like to tell that I think is a beautiful reminder of this message. It's a story of a husband and wife, and one day the wife develops a problem with her leg that causes her a lot of pain. So it continues for a few days to the point where they have to go, you know, to a doctor. So the husband takes a day off from work, takes her to the doctor, and when they're finally called into the doctor's office, the husband says, after the doctor asks, you know, hello, what can I do for you? The husband responds, "Doctor, my wife's leg, it hurts us." Did you catch that? It hurts us. That's a team. That's a marriage. That's moving from me to we. Where the pain in your spouse's leg hurts you. Where you embrace the problems in you and your spouse's life as if they are your own. Because the truth is, in a marriage, in we, your spouse's problems, they are your own. Whatever problems exist between the two of you, within each of you, in the context of your family, your children, your spouse's work, your spouse's health, your work, it's all one. There's a unit there. There's a team there. You see, in unsuccessful marriages, people tend to view each other separately. And the attitude is kind of like, well, you know, she's your mother, you deal with it. Or, you know, I'm going to work. You're responsible for the kids, so solve it. Or, I don't know how we're going to pay that bill. You know, that's your job. You know, I'm gonna pick out the fabric for the new couch. I don't know which fabric to pick. The designer's showing me three alternatives. That's my challenge. Don't ask me my opinion about fabrics. I don't care. Whatever you want to do. Remember, sometimes, you know, I'll be at public seminars speaking, and after I speak, I do a book signing. And, you know, in addition to the book, I have some of my other materials there. So a wife will come up sometimes and be looking at the materials. She'll say to her husband, you know, should we, what do you want to get? Should we get the book, or do you want to get the Home Flex kit? Or do you want to sign up for the Tele Boot Camp? You know, what do you think we should do? So he'll be like, you know, spaced out. I don't care. You know, whatever you want. Really, it's okay. Now, a lot of people would say, wow, whatever you want. He's not controlling. You know, he doesn't have a strong opinion. They must have a good marriage. Right? She's allowed to do whatever she wants. But that's not a good marriage. That actually is reflective of why they were there to begin with. Because he's so uninvolved. And she, in the way that she's interacting with him, is not able to engage him for whatever reason. He just missed an opportunity there. Not an opportunity to make a decision or control the situation, decide how much money they spent and whether they got the book or the Home Flex kit, but an opportunity to connect with his wife, to work on something, albeit little, but to work on something together. And when you make a choice together, when you solve a problem together, then you can't make a bad choice. You might not get the result that you're looking for in the choice that you made, but you'll get the result you were looking for in the problem you attempted to address. You'll get the results you were looking for in your marriage, in your relationship, by attempting to address the problem together. But too often people don't feel each other's pain, not involved with each other's problems, disconnected. I've got enough going on in my life. I can't handle your problems and your issues too. Just fix it. Just deal with it. Let me know what you decided. If there's no blood and nobody's in the emergency room, leave me alone. But remember when you first met? Remember when you were courting each other and you fell in love and you were connected and the borders and boundaries came down? And then all of a sudden there was the moment when you could feel that there was something wrong. Somehow the one that you were in love with had stepped back a little bit. There was definitely something bothering him or her, something wrong in their life. You knew it wasn't you. It wasn't the marriage, because so much was going right, but something came up. And you would say to them, "What's wrong? What's going on?" And they would want to shield you from it. No, never mind. Forget it. Don't worry about it. I'll talk to you tomorrow. No. Don't shut me out. Don't shut me out. Let me in. Let me hear what your problem is. What are you challenged by? What happened? Let me help. Let's deal with this together. Don't shut me out of this. That's the ticket. That's the ticket. And if you ever did have the experience where somebody that you love did let you in to their problems, to their life, to their challenges, then somehow it made everything better. Not necessarily the problems or challenges. They may have been just as outstanding. But the fact that you were in it together, that you had company, that it was a shared pain and a shared challenge, did something to improve the relationship, which made your experience of the problem better. Do you see that? You see how the problem or the challenge may not have been resolved. It might not have been any better. But the fact that you were in it together made the experience of the problem better. Too often, when problems and challenges or flaws that we see in our spouse come up, we disconnect. We start to feel, hey, this wasn't part of the bargain when I got married. This wasn't what I expected. Oh, and you are exactly what they expected? People don't change? Things don't come up? And too often we feel that that's not what I expected, and so we disconnect. But you heard the expression, love is blind. So what does that mean? I think love is not really blind. I think the true love is seeing and still loving. Seeing all your spouse's problems, flaws, issues, challenges, and yet still loving them. Accepting them, being patient with them. Not that you might not want them to change, not that you don't see that they would be a better person if they would conquer those challenges or fix those flaws, not that you don't think your marriage might not be better if those challenges and issues were conquered, fixed, or resolved in some way. But it can transform the quality of your relationship, irrespective of what happens to the problems or flaws, simply by joining with your spouse, accepting them, embracing them, feeling their struggle, feeling their pain, and inviting and allowing them to be part of your struggle and your pain. And when you take responsibility for each other's challenges and issues, that's really when those challenges and issues can be used as a means for the ultimate end, which is the marriage. But so many people give up on their spouses when they see their problems. But everyone has problems. It's kind of like a hug. You know, love is like a hug. What do I mean? Think about a hug. You know, if you're there with your spouse now, try to hug their arm. Can you, or any part of their body? Can you hug a part of somebody's body? You can't do it. Give it a try. It's a weird thing. It's awkward. You can't hug a part of a person's body. If you're going to hug somebody, both people have to open their arms wide enough to let the whole person in. And you know when you know it's a good hug? When there's no space between you. When you're completely connected. When your armpits are brushed up against each other. Sometimes it's even a great hug when the bottom of the soles of your feet are on top of your spouse's feet. For that would be for the shorter one, right? In other words, when the smell of your armpits and the dirt of the sole of your shoes are on top of each other, when they are part of each other, that's a hug. That's love. That's connected. It's connected, right? For better or for worse. And the worse really does give you an opportunity to love, to connect. You know, if you were to sculpt two people hugging, you wouldn't do it from two blocks of clay and then try to join them. You'd start with one block of clay. And from there, you could carve two people hugging. And that's the experience of love. Is there is a certain oneness that includes all aspects of the marriage, of the relationship, and of the individuals. Now, don't get me wrong. I want you to know I'm not expecting you to be excited about your spouse's problems. Yeah, I know that you're not excited about your spouse's problems. Hey, my spouse has a compulsive neurotic disorder, and I love the fact that I have to take inventory of the toilet paper. No, I know you don't like that. Hey, I can beat that one. My spouse eats more in the middle of the night at 3 a.m. than you could eat in an entire day. I know you don't like that. I know you don't like whatever your spouse's problems and challenges are. You don't like your own problems and challenges. That's the point. It doesn't matter whose problem it is. In fact, for soulmates, we know whose problem it is. Soulmates know whose problem it is. And whose problem is it? That's right. It's our problem. And the question is, how are we going to solve it? So, we stand together, united, as a team. And our problems, our issues, and our challenges, whether they come from our marriage, from one of us, from our in-laws, from our parents, from our kids, from our business, they're over there. So we are standing here united as a force against them. It's us against them. You see, too often in a marriage, it evolves to the point where, metaphorically, you're sitting on one end of the table, your spouse is sitting on the other end of the table, you're facing each other, and the problem is in the middle. It's between you. It's dividing you. And you might even try this, not just metaphorically, but actually try this as an exercise if you're willing, and that is to sit with your spouse on the same side of the table and to place on the other side of the table a card with the title of the problem, challenge, or issue that the two of you are facing, and begin to reorient yourself to the problem, to the issue. Hey, it's us against it. I can't tell you how many times in the course of a day I'm in private sessions with people, and the person there will be confessing their spouse's sins. It's very easy to do. It's very easy to see what your spouse's problems are. But of course, there's two major things missing here, one of which we've already discussed and one we're discussing now. The one with which we've already discussed is, okay, I know what your spouse's problems are, but let me ask you a question. What's your fixing? What's your fixing? Right? What's your role and responsibility in this? This can't all be his fault. I have, by the way, have never, ever, ever seen a situation where there's not dual responsibility. So what's your role? What's your responsibility? What could you do to make things better? And wouldn't it be more impactful to your situation for us to discuss and to work on that? And the second thing is, the way, and this is the new piece for tonight, is the way people talk about their spouse's problems and issues, they talk about it like they're pointing the finger from a place of judgment. You know, he's got to fix this porn problem. Right, he's got to learn to become a better parent and deal with our kids better. She better get the business in shape and start to improve our financial situation and stop shopping so much. It's all about pointing the finger and their improvement. But to what extent are you willing to be part of that problem? To what extent are you willing to help? Not judge. Not instruct or fix. Right, very often that's a big male problem. Oh, you want me to be involved? Okay, I'll help. Let me show you how to fix this. But that's not helpful very often. Very often what people need when they have a problem is not a solution, but company. That's the solution when it comes to the problem as it relates to the marriage, is they need you to be a part of it. Are you willing to do that? Have they invited you before and you rejected them? And of course, to what extent have you invited them to be a part of your problems? I want you to know this is really very powerful, because you realize that if you can succeed to do this, you can transform the very issues that brought you to Mort Fertel to begin with into issues that don't divide you, but they unite you. They're not the issues that bring you to Mort Fertel. They're the issues that you rally around that ends up being your healing. It can really happen. I've personally experienced it, and helped lots of people achieve it. Now, I just want to tie this into something important that we've been developing and talking about over the course of the last 5 weeks. And it's relevant for everybody, but particularly relevant for people in the Lone Ranger track. And that is, you have to be very careful with this idea. I don't want you to go running to your spouse tonight or tomorrow and say, okay, look, I know I've confessed all of your sins. I know you have all these problems and challenges and flaws, but I spoke to Mort Fertel tonight on a teleconference, and I'm ready to help you with them. I'm ready to be part of the solution to your problems. Let's go to work. You can't do that. Because who said that your spouse wants you to be part of the solution to their problems? Who says that they even acknowledge that they have the problems that you think or you say that they have? That's not the way I would begin here. The way to begin is, of course, to be open to becoming a part of your spouse's problems, issues, and challenges. But more importantly, is to evaluate your own life, your problems, your challenges, your flaws, and to lead by example. In other words, to take the opportunity to invite your spouse to help you with them, to be a part of it with you, include them in your problems. And that's one of your major tasks, as you'll find out from the workbook this week, is to invite your spouse to help you with something that you're working on that needs fixing. Now, this can be anything, by the way. You have to realize that the part of the point of my presentation here is that it doesn't matter if you're dealing with a dramatic problem like an eating disorder or infidelity, or a small problem like you can't figure out how to get the family computers to network. It doesn't really matter what the problem or issue is. Regardless of what they are, they won't cause the deterioration of your marriage if you handle them right and if you handle them correctly. They can create and manifest a connection in your marriage. So if you're dealing with something dramatic like an eating disorder and your spouse hasn't known about it for 15 years and you're ready to come clean and really work on it because you realize that something is destroying your family, compromising your ability to be a mother, and causing a deterioration of your marriage, well then great. Go to town. Open up. Tell your spouse that you want help. You want them involved. And extend them an authentic invitation to help you fix this thing in your life that's been plaguing you for years. That can be a very powerful experience. But if you're not ready to deal with that, if you're not ready to do that, if you don't feel safe, or you're just, you know, for whatever reason, intimidated by that, don't let that deter you from the assignment. Find something seemingly meaningful, mundane. Some problem, issue, or challenge. You can't quite figure out which cabinetry you should choose for the new kitchen. Will you help me with that, honey? Can we work on that together? Oh, thank you so much. I feel so much better having worked on that with you and know that you're on board with what we decided. Now, you might be thinking, what? More, this sounds good, but you don't understand. This won't work in my case. That's the climate. Everybody always says that. It won't work in my case. Everybody always thinks their situation is unique. Why won't it work in my case? Look, my spouse doesn't know the first thing about my problem. He couldn't begin to help me resolve it. I lost my mother about 6 months ago. My heart is just in pain. And I had some unresolved issues with her. And I just can't seem to get over this. I'm really struggling. But you have to understand, my husband, he's like the Marlboro Man type. He's not the sensitive type. He wouldn't be able to help. He won't understand. I'd be wasting my time. Or how about this one? Look, one of the major problems in our marriage is we're having financial challenges. And I'm really the financial engine in the family. I'm having terrible problems in my business. We're on the brink of bankruptcy. But my wife, she can't even balance a checkbook. She doesn't know the difference in a stock and a bond. What are you telling me? I should go to her and involve her in my business and financial problems? I'd be wasting my time. So listen carefully. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if your spouse can help you with the problem or not. It's not the point. The point of the exercise is not for you to solve the problem, although I hope you do. And very often, two is better than one, and they can help. But the real point is to transform the problem from one that divides you, hey, that's your problem, you deal with that, into one that unites you. This is our problem, something we're working on together. It's to move it from a me experience to a we experience. And as is the case with everything that I teach you, this is not a technique. This is not a fix my marriage strategy. This is something you want to make a habit. And of course, that takes time. Forming a new habit, as we've talked about, is not easy. But that's what I'm asking you to do here, is to reorient yourself and to form a new habit. And that habit is the habit of reaching out to your spouse and inviting and including them into your problems, issue, and challenges. Now, don't expect the change to happen overnight. They might not be open to it. They might not be receptive to it. They might not expect it. They might not have to deal with it because you've shut them out for years. Start slow. Start small. And don't just do it once. Commit yourself to making it a pattern, making it a habit in your life. To move something from a me experience to a we experience really changes the quality of your relationship. And to do that, you don't have to solve the problem. You simply have to attack it together. I'll tell you a secret. I mentioned it before, I'll mention it again. In marriage, problems are not the problem. They're completely neutral. They can either destroy your love or help you create love. It's really up to you. It depends on how you and your spouse handle them. If you can get on the same team, you can live with anything. And if you don't, the slightest problem, even a garage door open, is going to drive you nuts and drive you apart. So this week I want you to begin to reorient yourself and focus on being a team. Really get introspective. Evaluate yourself, your life, your challenges, your flaws, your issues. Be intelligent about where things are at in your marriage. And pick something, even if it's small, something small that you can reach out to your spouse with and invite them to help you with. And by the way, there's another reason why, from a psychological point of view, this can be very powerful. Because, of course, people love to help. People love to be asked their opinion and to be empowered and feel like, you know, they're the expert. Many people, actually, as I think I've mentioned on the Q&A teleconferences, they want to know, you know, how can I get my spouse involved in private sessions with me, with you, Mort? And as I mentioned, one way to do that is to ask them to help you, ask them to help me help you. Meaning that maybe the session's not about your marriage. Maybe it's not directed toward them at all. But they're the expert with me. Maybe I have the clinical experience. Maybe I have the expertise in terms of this being my profession. But they have the expertise in terms of their knowledge of you. As a team, we might be able to be very helpful for you And that's very empowering. Now, I'm not saying that's right for every situation, but it's just an example of one way to move from me to we, and to invite your spouse to be part of your challenges. I'll just conclude with one final story, or I should call it an ancient teaching. But there's an ancient teaching which says that when two people are in love, they can sleep on the edge of a razor blade. And when they're not, no bed is big enough. It really doesn't really matter what kind of problems you have in your life or in your marriage. If you can navigate your way to uniting around them, I can't promise what will happen to the problems, but I can promise what will happen in the context of your marriage. And that is, you'll connect. You'll unite. And there'll be love in your life.